Welcome to Maxed Out Man, helping you become the man you were made to be.
Hey guys, it's Kevin Davis from the Maxed Out Man podcast. We are here, episode 56, and I'm here with Dr. Glenn Livingston, PhD. He's the managing director at Defeat Your Cravings, LLC, is a veteran psychologist. He was a longtime CEO of a multi-million dollar consulting firm and serviced several Fortune 500 clients in the food industry, which I think is super interesting. You may have seen his previous work, theories and research in major periodicals or other major media outlets. He says disillusioned by the traditional psychology had to offer overweight and or food obsessed individuals. Dr. Livingston spent several decades researching the nature of binging and overeating via work with his patients, which I think you just said over 2000, and self-funded research program of more than 40,000 participants, which is that's a big study. I don't think there are a lot of studies out there that are doing, you know, have that kind of number. So
it was in the days when internet clicks were cheap, like 1999.
We could
recruit people, have them take a survey, tell us a couple of things. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
Not as impressive as it sounds, but yeah.
Well, we like big numbers, so we'll use it. But hey, thanks for coming on board. I'm super interested in this topic. I think you're the first guest that I've had with this particular expertise. And I've said it before on this podcast. A lot of times this information is for my own edification, and then I like other people to listen along. So I'm super interested in this. So welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to help with anything along the way.
So I think, one of the things I love doing is just getting to know the guest and kind of your background and how all this came about and kind of your expertise. And so talk as long as you want about that. I'd love to hear more.
Well, if you were ever in Syosset, Long Island, and you stopped at the Woodbury Country Deli and they're out of pizza and Pop-Tarts, there's a good chance I was there before you. which is my kind of cute way of saying it. I'm not just a doctor who decided to work with overeaters. I'm a former binge eater myself. I had what you would call exercise bulimia originally, but I was almost 300 pounds to the best of my knowledge. I got fed up with myself around 257 and stopped weighing myself, but I got pretty big. And the doctors were yelling at me that I was going to die by the time I was 30 or 40. It kind of started when I was a kid, and I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4". I am modestly muscular, just genetically I'm lucky. And so if I worked out a couple of hours a day, I could eat whatever I wanted to. Whole pizza was nothing for me. Boxes of muffins, boxes of chocolate bars. If it wasn't nailed down, it was fair game. And I was happy about it. It didn't seem like a problem. It was, like Doug Graham calls it, a superpower. When I was young, it worked out great. I maybe spent a little too much time sleeping it off and going to the bathroom, but I didn't care. I was, thin and happy, and everything was going great when I was a kid. Okay. So then maybe 5 years later, I'm in graduate school, and I'm commuting 2 hours each way to see patients and take classes, and my metabolism has slowed down a little bit. But I found that I couldn't stop eating the way that I was eating. It's like the food had a life of its own. And worse yet, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I'm from a family of psychologists. Being a great psychologist has always been the most important thing, right? Like, and to be a great psychologist, it's not just an intellectual game. It's not just like people come in and they show you the puzzle of their life and you say, rotate this one here, rotate that one there. And they say, I'll get right on that, doc. Right? It's more like you have to be able to lend them your soul and get them to love and trust you enough so that they are willing to think new thoughts and try new things and leave their comfort zone. And I was hindered in my efforts to do that back then. I'd be sitting with a suicidal client thinking, when can I get to the deli? Or, a couple that was on the verge of divorce and thinking, I need to get the next pizza. I compensated by working really hard and going over sessions and getting a lot of supervision. I never lost a client or anything like that, but I wasn't there. I wasn't 100% present, and it always bothered me, more so than the weight at first. Being from the family that I was from, I originally thought that the problem must be that I've got a hole in my heart, and a metaphorical hole in my heart, and I've got to fill that so that I don't have to keep trying to fill the hole in my stomach. And so I went to the best psychologists and psychiatrists and Overeaters Anonymous. And I went to on a spiritual journey, and I took medication for a little while. And every time I would try something, I get a little thinner and a lot fatter, right? And this went on for about 20 years. But in the interim, there were a number of things that happened that caused me to eventually switch the paradigm from love yourself thin to be the alpha wolf of your own mind. Mm. And yeah, it's more of a tough love approach. And there's a lot more to it scientifically now that I understand, but in terms of what cured me, here's what happened. I was married to a woman who traveled for business a lot. So I had a lot of time in my hands. I didn't commute. I worked at home. So I started a second career. I was a child and family psychologist with a full practice on Long Island. But at the same time, I was consulting for industry. I was consulting for big food companies, mostly, also Big Pharma, a couple of others, but mostly Big Food and Big Pharma.
All the favorite big industries of American society.
I was on the wrong side of the war.
Right.
Yeah. No, I was definitely on the wrong side of the war. I'm trying to make up for it now. I feel guilty about it, but I don't think
you should, but yeah, I think that's interesting.
Well, it's helped me to sell sugar sometimes to kids. I feel guilty about it. So I'm looking at what's happening there, though, and I slowly start to realize that they're engineering these hyperpalatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and excitotoxins and salt, and it's geared towards hitting the bliss point in the reptilian brain without giving you enough nutrition to feel satisfied. And, you know, so what's the result? Every time you're looking for love in a bag or a box or container, you're some fat cat in a white suit with a mustache that's laughing all the way to the back, right?
Yeah, right.
but Kevin, my point is, this had nothing to do with whether my mama didn't love me enough, or I was in an unhappy marriage, or, you know, I was struggling in some type of innate depression or loneliness or anxiety. This was an external force. And there were millions and millions of dollars paying rocket scientists to figure out how to do this. And it's targeted this part of the brain that doesn't know love. The reptilian brain, it knows feast or famine. It knows eat, mate, or kill. It's like a really bad college drinking game, right? There's no love there. It's the mammalian brain that sits on top of that, and the neocortex on top of that, that says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact is that going to have on your loved ones, on your tribe, on your family? And then in the neocortex, what impact is that going to have on your longer-term goals, on your health and your fitness and your well-being, on your contribution to society and music and art and spirituality and all the things that we think of as innately human? But this thing here is just eat, mate, or kill. And that gave me a clue that maybe I had the wrong paradigm. Maybe I should stop looking so hard at what ails me psychologically, even though I think all that made me a better person. And I should look more at, are there some practical techniques for waking up and taking control when that happened? I also saw that the advertising industry was exceptionally good at convincing us that we needed this stuff, that this is where the good stuff was, you needed to survive. For example, and people think advertising doesn't impact you, but it actually impacts you more when you think that, because your sales resistance is down.
As a guy that does sales and marketing and all that, I can tell you right now, that's our whole goal, right? Like, it's very good at what it does.
Not knock out the sales resistance.
Yeah.
Have people just unconsciously go along and be going down the aisle and not even know why they're picking up your product, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, I remember a food bar manufacturer that I work with, and they had figured out that if they took the vitamins out of the bar, they could save a little money. And all they really needed to do was make the packaging look diverse and colorful and shiny, because in nature, this is why they say eat the rainbow. If you see a salad with green lettuce and blueberries and red tomatoes and, you know, yellow carrots, you're getting a diversity of micronutrients. Mm-hmm. And so we've developed this variety impulse, this desire to seek diversity like that. But in this case, it was more predatory. They took the nutrients out and they made it look like that instead. And so that's another force that had nothing to do with my mama dropping me in my head. Finally, I do this 40,000 person study in the days when internet clicks were cheap. And I would intercept people when they were searching for some type of solution to stress. Stress management was the biggest keyword that we advertised on. And I would ask them, what were the foods that they struggled to stop overeating when they were stressed? And what were they stressed about? And when I looked at those results, what I saw was something kind of interesting, but it actually led me down a path that didn't really help. It was kind of like the final straw that got me to flip the paradigm. What I saw was that people who struggled with chocolate, they tended to be lonely or anxious or brokenhearted. People who struggled with crunchy, chewy things like, you know, salty chips and, you know, all those bags and boxes, they tended to be stressed at work. And people who struggled with soft, chewy, starchy things like pizza and bagels and pasta, they tended to be stressed at home. And before I was going to go talking about that publicly, because I thought maybe I was onto something, I decided I'm going to call my mom, who's also a therapist, and I'm going to ask her what she thinks about this. Like, what? Why in the world do I go running to chocolate? Because that always started my binges. Why do I go running to chocolate when I feel depressed or lonely or brokenhearted? So I call my mom and I ask her that. I was probably around 42, 43 years old. I'm 59 as we speak. And I said, Mom, why is this? You know, you have trouble with chocolate also. Why is this? And she gets this horrible look on her face. And she says, honey, I'm so sorry. I'm so. And I said, Mom, it's okay. Look, this is 4 decades ago. I'm just trying to figure this out. I just want to get better. What happened? And she said, well, you know, when you were 1 year old in 1965, your grandfather, my dad, had just gotten out of prison. And I had no idea he was guilty. I idolized him. He was my whole life. And he went to prison. And I didn't know where he was for 2 years. And, you know, the first year of your life, he was just getting out. And I was still getting over that. So I was very depressed and anxious all the time. When your dad was, you know, in the army at that time, he was a captain in the army. They were talking about sending him to Vietnam. And we were trying to have a second kid. And I thought, I'm going to be an army widow with 2 small kids and no way to take care of myself. And I was terrified. So you would come running to me wanting to be cuddled, wanting love, wanting to play, wanting healthy food. And I didn't have the wherewithal to make it for you because I was sitting and staring at the wall and just, you know, blanking out. And so what I did is I kept a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in a refrigerator on the floor. And I'd say, go get your Bosco, honey. And you'd go crawling over to the refrigerator and you'd open up the bottle, you'd suck on the chocolate, and you'd go into a chocolate sugar coma. And then I could resume staring at the wall.
Wow.
Right. So if this was a movie, right? If this was a movie, we would have had a movie moment, like we'd have a big hug and a big cry. We'd forgive each other, and then I'd never have trouble with chocolate again. Right. It was a very good conversation. I'm glad that I had it. I learned a lot more about my mom and what she was going through. I felt less self-hatred. I felt more compassionate towards myself for what I've been through. And I felt like it softened me up in some ways as a human being. But it made my chocolate eating worse. And all the other binging on top of that. The reason is there was this crazy voice of justification in my head.
Not my fault, right?
You're right, Glenn. Our mama didn't love us enough, and she left a great big chocolate-sized hole in your heart. And until you can get out of the marriage or find the love of your life or fix the marriage, you're going to have to just go right at eating chocolate. Yippee, let's do it right now. Go feed me, right? And I said, what is this thing going on? At that point, I flipped the paradigm. At that point, I said, maybe what I have to do is take charge of that voice of justification. Maybe it's not about solving all my emotional problems. Maybe I have to take charge of the voice of justification instead. Kind of like if your emotions were a fire. If you have a well-contained fireplace in the living room, that's an asset, not a liability. Mm-hmm. Right? People gather around and they hug and they cry and they make memories. If there are holes in the fireplace, then the ashes can seep out and burn down the house. And I hypothesized that that's what was happening, and I had to take control of this thing that was poking holes in the fireplace with all the excuses. Okay. There's a lot of scientific reasons why what I'm about to tell you actually worked, but it's a little crazy. I want to tell people up front, it's also a little embarrassing for a sophisticated psychologist like me to admit it, and that you don't have to do exactly what I did. You can use different names for things, but this is what I did, and I wasn't going to teach this back then. I said, I'm going to draw a line in the sand that's going to function like a tripwire so that I know when the reptilian brain is getting active, because I'm going to take control like the alpha wolf. I'm not going to say, oh my goodness, someone needs a hug. I'm going to find some way to say, get back in line or I'll kill you, right? Like alpha wolf would growl and snarl. And that line originally was, I will never have chocolate during the week again. I'll only ever have it on a Saturday. That way, if I was in a Starbucks and there was a big old chocolate bar at the counter calling to me as I was getting my coffee, and it said, go ahead, Glenn, you can start your silly diet tomorrow. You worked out hard enough. It's not going to hurt. I could say to myself, you know what? That's not me. That's my inner pig. Mm. My pig is squealing for pig slop. Chocolate on a Wednesday is pig slop. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. As ridiculous as that was, it wasn't an immediate cure or anything like that. But what happened immediately was it cleared away the confusion. It kind of set my mind straight on the fact that there was this lower part of my brain that wanted the chocolate, and there was this upper part of my brain that knew it was a bad idea. And it created an alarm system so that I knew immediately when that was about to happen. It's kind of like it opened up a space between stimulus and response. Mm-hmm. And then it was a matter of what I was going to do there. For my own personal recovery, the way that it worked was very logical. I fixed my thinking about food. So the pig would say, it'll be just as easy to start your silly diet again tomorrow. Or I'd say, wait a minute, that's not true. The principle of neuroplasticity says that what fires together wires together. So if I have a craving for chocolate and I think, let's just start tomorrow, and then I eat the chocolate, I will have reinforced both the craving and the thought. So I'm more likely to have a deeper craving for chocolate tomorrow. And tomorrow I'll be more likely to say start tomorrow because I've already reinforced those little things. So if you're in a hole, man, you got to stop digging. Always use the present moment to be healthy. Right? Mm-hmm. That's an example of what I would call a cognitive refutation or fixing your faulty thinking about food. Okay, the next 8 years, and it doesn't take 8 years anymore. It takes like a month or so to do this. But back then it took me 8 years. Because I didn't have all these other tools. The next 8 years, I keep a journal. I'm hyper alert to when the pig is active, what's it saying, what's wrong with it. I write it all down. It's kind of me versus the pig. And I did some other things also, but I played with different kinds of rules. And I did discover that it was better to set a lower bar than a higher bar because it was more important that I recognize that I was in control as opposed to letting things run rampant. But I got better, you know, I came down roughly about 80 pounds, depending on where you measure the starting point. And, all kinds of other things got better. My triglycerides, my psoriasis, my eczema, all the kind of stuff got better. But, as I was getting divorced, I thought, you know, maybe this could be something. I was going to have to close down some of the businesses I was running. And I thought, I want to do something meaningful. I happened to have, from my marketing consulting days, happened to have been a minor partner in a publishing company. And I called the CEO and I said, you know, I'm thinking about writing a book. And he was actually at the time in that company teaching authors how to market their books. And he said, you know, Glenn, I think we would do better marketing our own books because I can't get these authors to do what I need them to do. They just have these fantasies and they just won't do what they have to do. So I sent him the book. He calls me back 2 weeks later and he says, Glenn, donuts are pig slop. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. He proceeds to lose almost 100 pounds over the next 18 months. And so along the way, we kind of said, there's something here. Publish that. Slowly but surely, I took the necessary steps to market it. The right way, the long way, not with all the marketing tricks, the long way. And garners a million readers. I got a column in Psychology Today, get another million readers there. We're getting all these requests for coaches. It's not quite an order, but we get all these requests for coaching. I form a program. I trained some coaches to work with me. Over the course of the next 8 years, I work with that partner, and we saw over 2,000 clients. Essentially, what we did was we consolidated how quickly you could fix your thinking about food. We studied all the different crazy things people told themselves, you know, not only just our tomorrow, but a little bit won't hurt, or this is the wrong diet. We got to find the right one and keep binging until we do, et cetera, et cetera. We figured out there are less than 50 things that people say to themselves to convince themselves. And we figured out how to fix that. Got to the point that as we're measuring results within 1 month, people report an 89.4% reduction in overeating episodes. If they engage with their coach. If they don't engage, we don't get the results. Okay. When we get towards the last year, my partner and I kind of decided we wanted to go in different directions. He wanted to do more software. I wanted to do more of the human work. So I thought to myself, this is a really good opportunity to update the original book. Actually, there were 6 more books after that, but I really want to update everything because I really haven't updated it with everything that we've learned. And also, I don't like where the results go at 6 months. At 6 months, it was down to more like 55 or 60%. At a year, maybe even a lower than that. And it was bimodal, meaning that it was comprised of people who kept doing the stuff and the stuff kept working and people who just dropped out. Mm-hmm. So I said, why are people dropping out? That's what I need to know. And over the course of the year that we were separating, I talked to my clients about, like, why do they get to the point that they drop out? And the answer was that inevitably there is this screw it, just do it response. Like, I know there's nothing right about this thinking. I know all my thinking is wrong about this. I don't have any good excuses, but oh, what the hell? I just gotta, you know, give me the chocolate or nobody gets hurt. Then I said, what's driving that? Why, if I can fix people's thinking about food and take away these excuses, why do they get to the screw it, just do it response? That was a very interesting answer. There were about 7 reasons, and they all fall under the category of what psychologists would call organismic distress. So one of the biggest reasons could be that they're not nutrifying themselves correctly. They get panicked about losing weight. They're skipping meals. They're not getting, you know, enough leafy green vegetables. I mean, I'm not a dietitian or a medical doctor, but I see this all the time. And so, for example, I tell people, you can't just give up chocolate. You got to figure out what need that was fulfilling. And I would start to have green smoothies to fill that craving. Mm-hmm. They were not as delicious as the chocolate was. I would not, you know, chocolate is kind of like getting high with food, right?
It's, yeah. Well, it's a dopamine response, right? And all that, right? Yeah. So,
if I had a kale banana smoothie or a kale juice and banana smoothie, I would find that I would feel satisfied. I would not feel extremely exotically pleasured the way that I would mm-hmm. when I had a chocolate bar, but I would feel satisfied and there would be no crash. And so I saw that if I could get these people to flood their body with nutrition on a regular basis, at a slight caloric deficit if they needed to lose weight, that they were much less likely to get this screw it, just do it response. Problem is, it's very hard to get people to change their diet. That's the problem. And I've always promoted this as diet agnostic. I tell people, unless you're trying to starve yourself, I can probably help you as long as you're eating a reasonably nutritious diet. Like, let's even forget about the carnivore versus, you know, vegetarian argument. Mm-hmm. Just get a lot of this processed food out of your life or regulate it. And that's how I can help you to stop overeating. And for the most part, that's true. So the people who would start having more nutrients throughout the day would do better, but not everybody would do that. So what else could be causing it? It turns out that willpower, I'm aware I'm talking an awful lot, so if you need to jump
in. No, you're good. You're good. I'm listening along. We're good.
Okay. So it turns out that willpower is not really a fixed gift that certain people have and other people don't. It's more like you wake up with a certain amount of willpower in the tank and you burn it over the course of the day by making decisions. Willpower is the ability to make good decisions. You can only make so many good ones over the course of the day. This is why if you're struggling with overeating at night, it's important to plan your food for the nighttime and the morning. And it's not just food decisions that are causing the problem. It's you know, who's going to take Jenny to soccer practice? And do I spam, delete, delegate, or delay this email 4,000 times a day that I'm trying to figure that out, right? Yeah. And so I started to have people, which I'd kind of stumbled onto before, but never formalized it like this. I started to have them take decision-free breaks over the course of the day. Like, can you take 10 minutes twice a day, put your phone down, get away from your computer, go outside if you can, but if you can't, go hide in the bathroom so your kids can't get you, and just take 10 minutes and breathe and think. I know the bathroom is not the best place to breathe, but you know, it's better than being.
Yeah, right. It depends on your environment, right? It depends
on what you had for dinner last night. I shouldn't be too adolescent on the show. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. I mean, if Taco Bell was on the menu last night, you probably want to find a different location.
You want to get outside, man. Yeah. Okay. No, I can't think. So that helped. If I can get people to do that. There's a type of breathing that helps also. It turns out, one time I had this kind of mediocre date, but the woman was nice and she was into yoga. And I, when she found out what I did for a living, she said, I used to be a binge eater at night until I started doing 20 minutes of yoga before bed, and now I don't even want to binge anymore. And I said, what is going on with that? Why does that work? I started talking to, I like yoga also, and so I knew a lot of yoga teachers, and I started talking to them. And they explained to me that the type of breathing that they teach you in yoga, it's called parasympathetic breathing. Mm-hmm. And you're often breathing out for longer than you breathe in, especially at the end. And if you're breathing out for longer than you breathe in, you trigger a response in the brain that says there's no emergency here. Because if there was an emergency, if you had to be running from a hungry bear, you would have to be going, mm-hmm. get air as fast as you can. So it turns out Laurie Hammond calls them 7-11 breaths. If you breathe in for a count of 7 and out for a count of 11, I'm not doing it now because it takes a long time. If you take 7-11 breaths, the moment that you wake up and you realize your reptilian brain is active, you can take yourself from a state of urgent doing, screw it, just do it, I need these resources now, to relaxed being. And that's the purpose of the breath. So you always have the breath with you. It's easier to fix the screw it, just do it response with the breathing than it is by totally revamping your nutrition. Then there were things like there were things like dehydration, not getting enough sleep, even being too isolated from your tribe, even feeling like you don't have enough contact. Not that you have to be a social butterfly, but you do need to have a tribe that you know you can contact, who cares about you, so that, you know, you wouldn't die in your apartment alone and nobody's going to find you for 3 weeks.
Yeah. And not a tribe that only wants to meet you at the pizza restaurant, right? Like that's,
yeah, yeah.
That's important.
Yeah. But you know, we're a pack animal. And so as an organism, we experience organismic distress if we're too isolated. It was very dangerous to be too isolated when we were evolving 100,000 years ago. And so that's the essence of my journey. So I wrote a new book called Defeat Your Cravings. I hadn't included a lot of scientific understanding of what's going on with cravings formation and cravings extinction. And that led to a lot of misunderstanding of when people are having cravings and what to do about them. We can talk about that in a little bit if you want to. But I updated everything. I incorporated how to overcome the screw it, just do it response. I incorporated a lot of information about the science of cravings and the extinction curve. And I kind of integrated it all into this 8-step process, which is more comprehensive and has the benefit of, you know, having worked with 2,000 clients and having had 2 million readers and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
That's great. I mean, there's a ton. I'd like for you to go through some of the the research and scientific and hormonal and all that. I do want to ask you, you know, I'm more of a holistic kind of approach to health and fitness and that kind of thing. So it's, I'd love for you to kind of contrast, or how do you include both the psychological mind response versus the more physiological body aspect to defeating cravings, weight loss, longevity of weight loss, and all that? Because, like, you know, you have diet, nutrition, health, low sugar, or, you know, avoiding sugar, which I self-confessed, I'm a sugar. I actually do have a bit of a sugar addiction, but not a processed food sugar addiction. My wife is a baker. So if she bakes, you know, something, chocolate croissants or whatever, they better not be, she actually has to lock them up. We actually lock them up in a particular freezer, which I don't know if that's good behavior or not, but I I'm a weight training, you know, moderate cardio, cortisol control, all of these things. Can you kind of just talk about that? Because we talk a lot about health and fitness on this podcast. And so I'm interested to know kind of that holistic approach to defeating your cravings, losing weight, longevity of weight loss, those kind of things.
So what I mostly leave out of what I'm doing is solving emotional problems and traumas. I have compassion for people, and there is a lot of comorbidity with overeating and emotional problems in terms of how it all starts. Mm-hmm. But I believe essentially what's happened is you've initiated an automatic behavior loop, which, because the brain is a calorie acquisition machine and had to be in order to survive, it is very prone to automating and forcing those automations into an unconscious process that feels as if you're not even there. You know, most people don't know. Maybe the trigger for that is that they break up with their girlfriend and they feel like they want to go for cheesecake instead, and so they drive to the store. They're not aware of all of the processes that are happening along the way. So I tell people what I'm looking to do is to sever the link between emotions and overeating. And I feel compassion for the struggles you're going through, but that's something to work on with the therapist. It could take 5 years to overcome that kind of stuff. And there are very practical things that you can do to intervene in the automation of those behavior loops and start to extinguish them. So when you say holistically, the only psychological thing that I'm doing is looking at the excuses which lubricate the chute that goes from trigger to response that makes it possible for people to reverse their best intents, you know, despite believing with their whole heart and soul that they shouldn't have chocolate during the week or that they should follow X, Y, and Z rules. So I don't actually do a lot of traditional psychological work. We focus on eliminating those excuses, and then we focus on most of the things that you focus on, which are, you know, taking care of your body and your mind, mostly your body, to tamp down the cravings and prevent this screw it, just do it response. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, like, as far as like exercise and nutrition, obviously that's, you know, you're eliminating the major cravings. And I was happy to hear, you know, you're talking about making sure you actually get good nutrition, because it doesn't do any good to eliminate sugar. You know, this, if I crave chocolate, eliminate chocolate, but then eat, you know, a bunch of Velveeta with corn chips, right? Like that doesn't, you know, you have to make sure you get good food. And so you are recommending, you know, or other forms of exercise. Is that kind of your overall thing? How are you handling that?
I have the hardest time getting my audience to move.
Yeah.
My people are often usually women over 50 years old with 50 pounds or more to lose. That's the most, I mean, I do get younger people. I do get athletes, and I love working with those people. I have the hardest time getting them to move. So I asked them if they could walk around the block. You know, I asked them if they could set a low bar. I'll never go to bed without a 5-minute walk again or something like that. I just try to get them to get started. And then eventually I ask them to work with someone like you to get a real program and get moving. When I have the luxury of working with an athlete, then I do find that it's important to focus on the recovery nutrition. I you would know better than I, but I think there's about a 1 hour window after your workout when you can reglycogenate the muscles. And I know for me, I do hot power yoga and I walk on the beach and I'm a very active person. I have to take, you know, a few hundred calories of fruit, and I have a green supplement that goes along with that. And I've got to eat afterwards or else I'm craving all day long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's kind of this dynamic, and there's research in different ways on whether or not you know, dextrose beforehand, and, you know, whether you eat beforehand or after, and how the glycogen stores are used. And obviously your intensity of exercise makes a difference, and, you know, all that. Interestingly enough, in terms of movement, I was actually listening to Andrew Huberman, who's a, you know, neuroscientist,
and Huberman Labs.
Most people are familiar with his podcast. If you're not, and you're interested in science at all, it's super, awesome. Super interesting.
Awesome stuff. Yeah.
I was listening to one this morning that was a couple of years old, and he was talking about this study that they did about effectively it's fidgeting. So this study, they went through and they had two groups of people that could basically eat whatever they want. They never gained weight. And then people that could eat the same amount or less and actually gain a lot of weight. And the difference was the fidgeter. They figured out that the people that are more fidgety typically, and this is they call it a kind of a shiver response, which is therapy and all this stuff. But what they found is someone that literally will just, if you purposely sit at your desk and move your leg, you know, bounce your leg, or you're, you know, like me, if I'm talking like this and I'm really animated, those people, and it was 800 to 2,500 calories extra burn per day.
Wow.
Per day. Yeah. Wow. So, and I'll email you the copy of this YouTube video that I found, and I'll put it in the show notes as well. But it was, so for those people, for that population, he was basically saying, if you do nothing else and you're not quite ready to exercise, and it's not, you know, it's not in lieu of actual exercise, but this is a great way to increase your overall calorie burn with very little effort, whether it's, you know, literally just shaking your leg or, you know, drumming on your desk. It was really interesting.
Maybe sometime I'll have you on my show and you can talk all about how you can exercise without exercising. That would be,
I love that. Yeah.
No, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Cause obviously that's Andrew Huberman. There's two guys from the UK that did the research. So I'll actually put a post, a link in the show notes to this and send it to you. But I found it very interesting to do that. And I'm big on the whole mind body connection, and more, I'm not what you would call a woo woo guy, which I know you're familiar with that, with that phrase, I'm sure, but I'm more of a, like, you have to do, being fit and healthy is not as easy as what the people that sell health and fitness products would want you to believe, right? Like, it actually takes, in your case, we're defeating the cravings and we're talking about our inner pig. And in my mind, mine would be, let's kill our inner little bitch, which excuse the language, but but that's kind of the same idea, but it's all of those things.
I often tell people, either you're going to be your pig's bitch or it's going to be yours. Right. Which is it going to be? Are you going to take control or not? Yeah.
And I have to tell myself, well, often it's like, and even like through soreness and acute injury or whatever, it's like, I'm in control of my body. My body is not in control of me. And that includes stuff like cravings and sugar addictions or, you know, all of those things.
And that's how we live the rest of our life, right? Like, if you see an attractive woman on the street because your testicles generate this overwhelming biological urge, you don't run out and kiss her.
Right. Yeah.
Right. You know, there are ways to go about that. We're expected to be in control of that in a civil society. If you really have to pee in the middle of a business meeting because your bladder is really pressing for that,
you don't do it on the floor, right?
You don't just drop trow and do it on the floor, right? It's like, I'll say, look, I'm talking to Kevin. I'll take care of you afterwards, right?
Yeah. And what is it like? Why is that? I'm sure that part of this came out of the research that did, but why do we give ourselves, quote unquote, permission in the form, you know, whether it's food addiction, alcohol, drugs, and, you know, and all of that? Because yes, it's an addiction, it's a disease, and there's that whole argument between the two.
I don't believe that disease, but go
ahead. Good. I mean, I actually people would argue with that. I'm not one of those, because I'm more of a self-responsibility kind of guy. Yeah. And that doesn't mean it's not difficult. right? Like, even if you believe that you're in control of it, doesn't mean that it's an easy path. Mm-hmm. But why is it that we give ourselves, you know, we're not all serial rapists walking down the street, like you said. Why are we able to control that?
Why is addiction so rampant?
Yeah. And why aren't we able to not over? And food is one of those things, and I've heard it said from an alcoholic standpoint, you don't need alcohol to live. From a food standpoint, you actually have to eat the things that you're, the thing that you're lying out of the cage. Yeah, right?
Pick it out and walk it around the block three times a day, like they say in the 12-step programs. Yeah. Yeah. So let me just address the disease concept for a little bit. I'm adamantly against the concept of powerlessness because I think that it disempowers it alleviates guilt, which I can tell you other ways to deal with guilt instead. But it does so at a tremendous price because it takes away your ability to insert a space between stimulus and response and direct your life in the way that you want to direct it. So I tell people, just take a little bit of guilt and I'll show you how to get rid of the guilt. But what I think is actually going on, I understand the feeling of powerlessness. I felt like that for 20 years. The brain wants to automate the acquisition of caloric and nutritional resources. A woman walking down the street is something that we naturally evolved to respond to. Mm-hmm. Pornography is not, right?
Like right.
Five women naked in a room is not something that we naturally evolved to respond to. So we typically are not exposed in our everyday lives as we're walking past a woman down the street to, five women naked, kissing. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
A candy bar or a bag of corn chips or, even pasta to a certain extent is an unnaturally concentrated form of pleasure. And the brain, if you think about 100,000 years ago, it would be very difficult to find that many calories in that small space for that little effort.
Right.
And so the brain feels like it has to take advantage of that. And it wants to automate that so that you don't have to think about it. Get as many calories with little effort as possible. Because if you didn't take advantage of those scarce opportunities, you might die.
Like finding an ostrich egg or something like that, right? Like in the wild,
Right. So your brain thinks that if you don't have the corn chips, you're going to die, that you're going to need the resources later. As far as it knows, it's living 100,000 years ago. That's not a very long time for our brains to evolve and change to the modern food environment. So I understand feeling like there's something wrong with you, feeling compelled like you have to do it. That doesn't mean it's true. There's a difference between a very hard to climb mountain or even a moderately hard to climb mountain with a well-worn path and a mountain that's just unclimbable. Mm-hmm. And I think that the disease concept tells people that the mountain is unclimbable and they have to, constantly be accountable to sponsors and go to all these meetings and be taken away from their family and, kind of walk away from their original family values and adopt a devil made me do it personality. Mm-hmm. Like it's not my fault. It's this disease inside of me. I think it's actually very dangerous. And the evidence does not support that it really does any better than doing nothing at all. It's either at parity or worse than doing nothing at all. So if people get better through that process, God bless them. I don't want to take that away from you. But I think it's an abdication of free will and responsibility. And I think free will and responsibility is the only thing that's going to get you permanently better. That's my opinion.
Yeah. I've been using this phrase lately that, and I talked about this on probably the previous podcast, whenever this comes out, but there's this song in Christian music that says, "Dear younger me, it's not your fault." Mm-hmm. And I hate that line in that song. I like the song, but I hate that line in the song because mm-hmm. I've been using this phrase like it probably is your fault. Mm-hmm. But the good news is if it's your fault, then you have the opportunity and the means by which to fix that.
Yeah.
If it's not your fault, it's completely out of your control. So how do you change that? Well, if it is your fault, then because I'm of the opinion that in most cases, whatever state you're currently in is probably a result of decision making up to that point. you know, mm-hmm. within reason, obviously.
And that decision making may have been unfairly influenced by mm-hmm. childhood trauma or by the food industry and the advertising industry and even the addiction treatment industry. But even if it's not your fault, then you still have the opportunity to take responsibility and do something about it.
Right.
My other comment about the disease concept is that some people feel like they're broken, like they're incapable of overcoming their cravings. It doesn't logically make sense because the same scientific process in your brain, like the use of neurotransmitters and learning that forms a craving, is the same process that's responsible for extinguishing a craving.
Okay.
So unless your brain has been lesioned or you've had a, you know, serious brain trauma, if you're having cravings, you have the ability to unhave those cravings. So saying that you're broken or diseased doesn't really make sense. Would you like me to talk more about how cravings actually work and what?
Yeah, I love it. And I just want to say one thing that you had mentioned, managing guilt, and someone explained to me the difference between guilt and shame. Mm-hmm. And really that's what you're describing, because guilt is something, you know, that is as a result of something that you did that maybe you feel that guilt out of, but shame comes from what you're describing, which is there's actually something broken in me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but no, yeah. I love that. Explain how that craving response and then the extinguishing response works.
I didn't deliver on the promise to tell people how to get rid of their guilt, so let me do that.
Okay.
And we'll talk about cravings. We have time?
We have plenty of time, yeah.
Okay. If I accidentally touch a hot stove in my kitchen, am I supposed to say, oh my God, I'm a pathetic hot stove toucher, and I might as well put the whole hand down on the stove, right?
Right.
I'm not supposed to do that. What I'm supposed to do is say, how don't I miss the stove? How am I going to pay attention better in the future so that it doesn't happen again? Once I'm convinced that it's not going to happen again and I've turned guilt into responsibility, I'm supposed to let it go, because perseverating on that guilt is only going to make me too weak to aim at the target again. It's only going to make me feel too weak to resist the next binge. So what you want to do is let go of the guilt by turning it into responsibility and then moving on. And you're correct that where people get stuck is with character-based kind of shame attacks. We tell people that your pig will do its very best to try to make you feel horrible and pathetic and incapable of resisting after a binge. And it's interestingly very difficult to keep on overeating if you refuse to yell at yourself. Mm. If you collect evidence of success, and rather than saying, what's wrong with me, I'm pathetic, how come I can't stop eating, which sometimes I think if I hear it one more time, I'm going to climb up on top of a clock tower and put aluminum foil in my head and just start screaming, man. But I understand the experience. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to say, how can I stop? If you say, mm-hmm. why can't I stop? You're telling your brain to find evidence that you can't. You're going to develop a failure identity and feel powerless and diseased. If you say, how can I stop? Then, and what did I do right? Like, how did I have 5 cupcakes instead of 15? I had 15 in the past. How did I stop at 5? You know, I ate the whole pizza, but I didn't eat the box. I'm only half kidding. What did you do right? And how can you double down on that? And then say, what went wrong? How can I prevent this in the future? I don't want to touch the hot stove again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. So turn guilt into responsibility. That's how you get rid of it. And it's much easier to let go of guilt once you've done that, because your brain latches onto it because it's afraid that if you don't feel guilty enough, that you're going to experience the trauma again. So when you've gone through the process of figuring out how you're going to avoid it in the future, then your brain will let go of the guilt and let you move forward.
Which is interesting, because that's a very similar thing to what happens when you work, when you weight train.
Yeah.
So the purpose of weight training is to actually break down the muscle fiber, which then your body rebuilds that muscle fiber and adds a little bit more so that it can then get ready for that next, if that same stimulus happens again. So mm-hmm. that's how you get stronger, bigger muscles over time. And it's a psychological muscle in dealing with that guilt that actually can, that's actually, I would guess that that's a very similar process.
So How do you reassure your clients about that? I'm just curious if you take the analogy further.
Well, we try to differentiate between soreness and injury, for example, because one of the things that you have problems with when people weight train for the first time or after a long time not doing it or whatever is that my muscles hurt. And I always joke and say, look, I've been lifting weights since I was 15 years old. So I've been sore for 36 years. Mm-hmm. Like it just, I've been in some sort of minor soreness pain for most of my life. But that's, in my mind, I've trained my brain to say, that means I worked out. Like that's a welcome, satisfying feeling.
Okay.
So it's retraining the brain to say, okay, well, obviously if you went and lifted a generator when you shouldn't have, and you pulled you strained your back, that's a different kind of pain.
Okay.
But if your biceps are slightly sore, your chest is slightly sore, your quads are a little bit sore, and you have that discomfort, that's a reminder. It's actually, we use it as a physical reminder to tell you that you're doing what your body has done what you told it to do. And the next time it'll be ready.
Your body gets stronger through discomfort.
Correct.
Distinguish discomfort from injury. I really like that.
Because the soreness is a result of those microscopic injuries to the actual muscle fibers themselves. That's you have physically damaged the muscle. Not in an injury standpoint, but in just a microscopic level.
See, the brain extinguishes cravings through discomfort also. So I tell people to welcome the cravings in the context of a well-planned extinction curve. I'm going to get there in a second. But I tell them to welcome the cravings because the only way to kill a craving is to have a craving. Mm. So you want to get prepared and do a series of steps I'm going to tell you in a minute so that you can get through the extinction curve. But then you don't want to shy away from it because, you know, you almost want to say to your pig, bring it on, bitch. Bring it on. Right.
Right.
Right. Because if you do that, you know, you're going to be better in 30 days. You're going to be so much better in 30 days. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about cravings if we can. Okay. Okay. So the first thing is cravings don't mean that you're broken. They're just your brain doing what it was supposed to do 100,000 years ago. If we didn't get incredibly motivated to identify food signals and follow them to the acquisition of calories and nutrition, we would have starved. We wouldn't have had the motivation. We would have sat around, you know, looking at the women or the sunset, and we wouldn't have
staring into the fire we just invented, right?
Right. And by the way, back then, I don't think there was really such a thing as overeating. I don't think that was sitting around saying, Marta, eat way too much mammoth.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think that happened.
Yeah.
So what I want you to understand is that cravings are associated with signals, with food signals. Imagine we have a caveman named Thag, T-H-A-G, just because I like the name, no other reason. And Thag is out looking for, he's out gathering, he's out looking for fruit or berries or something like that. And he happens to follow a monkey to a banana tree. Mm. And he gorges himself on bananas and he takes bananas back to his home because, you know, it was pretty scarce and you get as much as you can when you could. And then Thag's brain makes an association to monkeys. And when Thag's brain sees a monkey again, it secretes dopamine. It says, follow that monkey, right? If Thag doesn't follow the monkey, Thag's brain lowers the dopamine levels below normal to make him miserable, saying, either follow that monkey or I'm going to torture you until you do.
Mm.
Right? Because it was an evolutionary advantage. It was a survival advantage to follow the monkey to the tree. Okay. Now, let's say you want to extinguish a habit. And I'm going to go back to Thag in a second. Let's say that I'm eating donuts every time I pass the donut store on the way home from work. So I make a rule for myself that says I'm never going to eat donuts on the way home from work again. And most people think that if I do that, that the worst craving is going to be on the first day, and then it's going to get a little better and a little better and a little better and a little better until it doesn't bother me anymore. But that's not actually what happens. What actually happens is that you have a little bit of a honeymoon period. It gets easier pretty quickly, and then you're going to have a worse craving than you ever had before. Why does that happen? So this is called the where the F are my donuts response. Or more professionally, the extinction burst.
Mm-hmm.
Why does that happen? And then what'll happen if you get through that is it'll go all the way down until about 25 to 30 exposures or so, be a couple little more bumps, and then you'll be mostly okay. Your brain will label the craving as dormant. It won't erase it because it wants to remember how it found calories in case they become available again, but it won't bother you anymore, more or less. Okay, why do we get this extinction burst and what do we do about it? Let's say Thag were to follow a monkey the next day and find bananas and the next day and find bananas. And this goes on for about a month. And so he always gets excited when he sees the monkey. He gets happy when he sees the monkey also, by the way. He doesn't have to get to the bananas. He can just see the monkey and the monkey makes him happy. Just like people often feel this excited experience when they see the donut store sign, mm-hmm. right? Or a, you know, a major brand sign. Because they know the reward is coming and they know they have to engage in this kind of automated behavior. But let's say Thag one day, later in the season, the banana trees are getting more scarce, and he follows a monkey to a tree that's empty. There are no bananas. Do you think that Thag's brain would stop secreting dopamine and say, okay, don't bother?
No.
No. And you know the reason why, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The reason why is that following a monkey to a banana tree that leads to bananas 80% of the time is a much better alternative to having no food signal at all, no monkeys at all, and just being on his own again, randomly trying to find bananas. So Thag's brain actually would double down and say, where the F are my bananas? You better test that. It wants to know if the bananas have become available at random in response to that particular food stimuli. As a matter of fact, following a monkey to a tree that had bananas 50% of the time, or maybe even 20% of the time, would still be better than not having the monkey food signal at all. So Thag's brain would continue to generate stronger cravings, even as it got later in the season and later in the season, and the bananas were scarce.
Is that kind of like a path to least resistance response versus, because it's easier for... it's easier to have an 80% chance of getting bananas than abandoning the banana, you know, kind of continuum altogether to go search for a different source.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Like if you have a business that was wildly profitable and then it was a little less profitable, it usually still makes sense to milk it until it's not profitable
at all. Not abandoning it to do a completely different thing. Right.
Yeah. Right. Right. So I go through this. What normally happens is people freak out when the extinction burst happens, right? They don't understand. I skipped a piece. I'll tell you in a minute. They don't understand when the extinction burst happens. And so at this point, their pig tells them, this is going to be torture forever. You know, this is what it's going to feel like forever. You got to give in, man, because you're going to be miserable forever. But it's not what happens. You, if you get through that, you'll go down. So what you want to do is prepare. Mm-hmm. You want to attend to all that organismic distress that we talked about, because you're going to be incurring more as you go through this. So pick a very specific stimuli like the donut shop on the way home from work, and then figure out how am I going to get a little more sleep over this next 30 days, particularly the next, you know, 5 to 10 days till I can get through that burst. How am I going to take care of my water? What extra can I do for my nutrition? Can I get some social support to make this happen? How else am I going to take care of myself and get through that burst? Right. And then once you're over the hump, keep going. Like if you climb over the prison wall, don't go back to see your friends.
Right.
Just keep going. Right. Keep going and run, man. Run as fast as you can. At the end of those 30 days, there's going to be a couple little more bumps, but they're not horribly awful to deal with. What happens when you're at the top and you eat the donut, you're setting up a random reinforcement schedule. It's called variable ratio random reinforcement or intermittent reinforcement. It's the most powerful reinforcement schedule we know of in the behavioral literature. This is the reason that little old ladies get stuck at the slot machine having to pull it constantly because they don't know when it's going to pay off. Mm. You're telling your brain the stuff is available at random. You better pull it all the time. It's the worst thing you can do. If you don't want to give up donuts, if you decide you don't want to give them up and you want to have them once in a while, what you want to do is bind it to a very specific context. So you could say, I'll only ever have donuts on Saturdays at 10 o'clock after my workout and no more than two. Your brain will then require all of those food signals to converge in order to know that the food is available. Just like if I were to set the slot machine in the casino to only pay off at 10 a.m. on Saturdays, the casino would be a ghost town during the week, right?
Right.
That's how your brain works. Okay. Two out of three people I find for any given substance are able to regulate and moderate it rather than having to give it up entirely. If your automation loops are too deep, if you've gone too far down the rabbit hole for too long, you might have to give it up entirely, at least for a period of time. Sometimes it's 90 days, sometimes it's 5 years, but you might have to let your brain recover from that. Okay. So then I get past the 30-day park. I do all this and I get past the extinction curve. 30 days later, I'm driving past the donut store. It doesn't bother me at all. I start to wonder, why did I ever do that? Why did I ever feel powerless? Why did I ever feel like I was powerless over donuts? It's no big deal anymore. You don't want to get cocky at that point and randomly reinforce it either. If you're going to start having donuts again, you want to do it contextually bound, like we talked about. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now suppose that I go to my grandma's house. My grandma's not alive anymore, but suppose she was. I go to grandma's house and grandma has donuts most of the time I'm there, and I haven't seen her in a couple of months. All of a sudden I have the worst cravings that I've ever had. And I can't believe it. I thought it was all done with donut cravings. What most people don't understand is that you didn't fail. You succeeded at extinguishing the donut store on the way home from work. You didn't go through an extinction curve for grandma's house. Mm. And so as a practical matter, any given craving is usually attached to a couple of different stimuli. Some of them are daily stimuli. Usually about 80% of them are daily, and people can think about the context in which they are having donuts and figure out what they're going to do about it. Some of them are infrequent, like grandma's house or, you know, going to a birthday party or something like that.
But grandma's house is like nostalgia and love and comfort and peace and all of those, right? That's a big psychological mountain, so to speak.
Any of those could be a food stimulus. Mm-hmm. Food stimuli can actually be internal, in particular emotional state. It could be the temperature or the smell of the ocean air that makes you want ice cream. There are a wide variety of things that can function as a food signal. It depends upon in what context did you find those calories.
Right.
And your brain makes that association. That's the principle of neuroplasticity.
Again. Right.
Okay. So what you want to do, since it doesn't take 30 days exactly for most food cravings to disappear or be labeled dormant, it takes 30 exposures. An exposure is when you're exposed to the stimulus and you don't reward it. So it's harder to extinguish the infrequent cravings. So it's harder to extinguish grandma's house because it's going to take a couple of years to get through that 30 times. So you want to recognize that you're going to have those cravings in those situations and then make a plan for it. Maybe you're going to have to eat something beforehand and drink some more water. Maybe you need to do a refutation. Like maybe your pig will be saying, oh, come on, it's grandma. You have to have it to please her. So maybe you need to make a plan about how else you're going to please her and be able to, you know, have a loving time at grandma's house without having the donuts. And then organize an email to yourself to show up before, during, and after you're actually at grandma's house. And make sure the subject line is attention getting. Just don't go like grandma's house email. Say, shut up, pig. I'm eating healthy at grandma's. It's got to be something that gets your attention in the middle of 1,000 emails during the day. And it also should include something emotional, because what's going to happen is you're going to forget about this whole thing by the time you get to grandma's house. Mm-hmm. And you need to bring back all the reasons that you wanted to extinguish the donut in the first place. So the last thing you need to know about cravings is that the brain responds preferentially to unexpected sources of calorie and nutrition. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because we were needing to constantly find new ones. You know, the banana trees would run out and we'd have to find the blueberries, or the blueberries would run out and we'd, you know, have to hunt the wild boar or something like that. Your brain is looking for new sources of pleasure. What this means is that if you have something particularly delicious that you hadn't expected to have or hadn't had before. It can take just one experience to form a new craving or a new addiction. Mm. I illustrate this by my friend Hank 25 years ago, who would sometimes be at a diner or something, and he'd take a bite of a new sandwich, and he'd say, "Oh my God, that's too good. And Glenn, if it's too good, then it's no good." Because he didn't want to have
that craving. That sandwich is off the menu forever. Yeah.
Yeah, for him. For
yeah.
Him. Or what I didn't know now, and he didn't either, was that he could contextualize it and just make a very clear rule about when he was going to have it. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing, is you want to be on the lookout for unexpectedly delicious new experiences. Now, I don't want to ruin your fun, right? I just want to alert you that this is how it works. And so what you want to ask yourself is, do I want this craving or not? If you don't, then make a rule to regulate it. You can use this experience to your benefit, though. You could find a dozen recipes for things that are on your plan. Like I make a vegan, flourless, saltless lasagna, which is actually really good. I got it from Dr. Furman's site. And I'll only allow myself to have it every other month or so, because I want it to feel unexpectedly delicious so that I crave it again. And if I happen to decide I really want to have it again soon, then I might have it. But this way I'm craving something that I feel is good for me, not something that...
Is it made with like the zoodles or where it's got zucchini noodles or anything like that?
It's made with eggplant and tomato paste and cashews. It's really good. It's really good. It actually does use some arrowroot flour in it. Sometimes I put it there, sometimes I don't. But there are no noodles or anything like that. The eggplant is, but I'm not trying to promote his lasagna. I'm just saying YouTube is a wonderful resource.
Oh, yeah.
Figure out how you want to eat, find a dozen recipes, learn how to make them, and then rotate them through so that you're craving things that satisfy you, that you don't feel guilty about instead. And see, the dopamine system is adaptable. It upregulates and downregulates depending upon what you're doing with it. So if I've never had chocolate before, the first day I have chocolate, it's orgasmically delicious. Right? If I have a chocolate bar every day, the second bar isn't quite as good as the first one. Mm-hmm. The third bar isn't quite as good as the second one, because my brain is downregulating and downregulating and downregulating the response. It's the same way that I slept underneath the subway in graduate school. It was an elevated subway, but I slept in an apartment underneath the subway. I couldn't sleep at all when I first got there. But day by day, my brain downregulated its response because it figured it wasn't a relevant stimuli. Now, the problem with downregulation and food is that you need more and more and more of a particular stimulus in order to feel satisfied. If you get that stimulus out of your system, or if you regulate it in the way that we talked about, then your system starts to upregulate. If I move to the country, then my hearing starts to upregulate. And if I happen to go back and sleep underneath the subway, I'm not going to be able to sleep again. If I stop having chocolate all the time or just have it once a week, my dopamine system is going to upregulate, and I'm going to get more pleasure. I'm going to get more pleasure from the naturally sweet things in my environment, like fruit or even sweet taste in certain types of vegetables and lettuce that most people are not aware of. Most people say they hate fruit and vegetables so they could never lose weight. And I'll tell them that, well, you hate them now, but any diet that people follow for 2 years, they'll tell you they absolutely love it.
Yeah.
And that's because the pleasure system is adaptable. And that makes sense because it had to be, right? Because the food source could change.
Right.
So when your pig says this is going to be torture forever, you're going to lose any sense of pleasure. It just doesn't happen. It just doesn't work like that. Those are the basics of what you need to know about craving.
I love it. Yeah. It's interesting. Just a personal share. One of the things with my craving. So one of the things I love is, semi-sweet chocolate chips, take a spoonful of peanut butter, stick them in, you know, you got a little thing of chocolate chips and that becomes chocolate and peanut butter. I like Reese's peanut butter cups and stuff. But I have this weird thing. There can literally be one of those big Costco size things of chocolate chips in my pantry. My wife's a baker, like I said. Mm-hmm. As long as it's unopened, I will not physically open it because I have, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. If it's open, that thing is gone in like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I have this craving. It's almost like the I've created a rule, which then I, you know, I've over time created a new rule, which is those are my wife's for baking. Even if it's open, those are not for me. Mm-hmm. But the easy rule is as long as it's not open, it's not for me. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's an interesting, and it's like that with almost everything that I create, you know, my cravings.
BJ Fogg wrote a book called Tiny Habits, where he talks about the three elements of behavior being prompt, ability, and motivation. It's a very good book, by the way. And when the prompt is stronger and more salient, when it would require less work to acquire, you have a stronger prompt and stronger ability to go and get the chocolate chip, so it becomes harder. You can develop the ability to resist no matter what.
Right.
And over time, I'm not telling you to change this, but over time, depending upon the environment you're faced with, it might be necessary for you to do that. Like I know a woman who's incredibly successful in defeating her cravings. And she came to the conclusion she couldn't have sugar or flour. Now she owned a bakery. And so
that's tough. Yeah.
And she's not only surrounded by this stuff all day long, but she has to make it seem sexy. She's got to sell it. And I asked her, well, how do you do that? How can you possibly not have any sugar or flour when you're talking about how delicious is it all the time and you're around the smells and everybody else is asking you how good it is? She says, oh, it's really easy. I just look at it and I say, that is not my food. Mm. She's made a very clear line. I never eat sugar or flour. I say, that is not my food. And she's able to do that because, you know, we had worked, you can work on your motivation, you can work on making the line really clear, and over time you can build that as a muscle. But it's work. It's work to do that. Yeah. I don't think you need to if your wife is willing to keep the bag closed.
Yeah. And we have these little lock boxes too that help with any sugar and stuff. I mean, it's, I always joke and say my inner fat kid gets really hungry at 2 a.m. So I need extra precautions to keep him out.
I do tell people that internal controls are better than external controls when you can develop them. I've seen people in the extreme. Like there was a woman who had her kids lock her in her bedroom at night.
Oh wow! Yeah,
because she was afraid that her chocolate werewolf was going to come out and go raid the cabinets. That's I don't tend to like solutions that restrict people's lives.
Right,
make you live a longer life. I want you to be able to seize the day and get out there and not have to think about food.
Yeah. And typically for me, like the lock boxes where she keeps, you know, where, for example, like, you know, Christmas is just a couple of weeks ago. And so you have the stocking and we typically have some sort of candy and that kind of stuff. I have her put that in there. And then like, just cause it makes my life easier if I'm trying to get leaner, which is, you know, it just requires a lot more regimen. So when I need to be more regimented, I will say, hey, I just like, it just takes that thing off my plate. So that I don't even have, there really is no willpower involved then because it's just not available. So, I'm lazy. That's my ability. That helps me be lazy with my willpower,
I think. Well, and we all decide where we want to spend our willpower and what adaptation we want to life in that way.
Yeah.
And also there's nothing wrong with setting up a cocoon to nurture your new habits.
Right.
So if you're really struggling with something and you, like sometimes people need to stay in the house for a couple of days and not watch TV and not go past all of their worst food triggers and work on stabilizing their blood sugar, like eat lower glycemic foods for a couple of days in order to get this out of their system and have lesser cravings before they go on a venture to, fight the extinction curve. Some people need to do that.
Yeah. And it's not in lieu of, you know, I wouldn't recommend someone lock the food up that they don't want to eat in lieu of actually addressing what you're talking about, which is we need to address the cravings for that food, not just lock it up because once you leave your house, it's available everywhere. And so you don't fix that, then you're in trouble.
But because each of these things requires a little work, you want to make an assessment of which cravings and situations are most troublesome to you and work on them one at a time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great place to land. How do we find more information about you? Where do we get the book? And I'll put these links in the show notes as well.
It's really easy. I'd like to give you all a free copy of the book at defeatyourcravings.com. click on the big blue button and sign up for the reader bonus list. When you do that, you'll get a free copy in Kindle, Nook, or PDF format. The electronic formats are free. We also do have Audible and hardcover and paperback, but there's a charge for that. When you sign up for the free reader bonus list, you will also get a set of food plan starter templates. So these are sets of rules you might want to consider. The program is diet agnostic, so whether you're ketogenic or, you know, low carb or high carb or point counting or calorie counting or macrobiotic, whatever you are, as long as you are willing to nutrify yourself regularly, we can probably help you. So we've got these plans we put some time thinking about. And then you'll also get a set of recorded coaching sessions. The reason I did that is because it's kind of abstract and weird. You must be thinking, why does Kevin have a doctor on who's got a pig inside of him? And it sounds like it would be a cold-hearted process, but it's actually a very compassionate, loving process that takes people from feeling despairing and confused and hopeless to feeling powerful and enthusiastic and hopeful in just one session. So wanted you to hear that. And it's all at defeatyourcravings.com. Click the big blue button.
That's awesome. That's a great resource and very, very generous of you to give that to the community. And I realize that that's something that's a way for you to serve and give back and utilize that to help people. So that's super cool.
Yes. And I didn't hold anything back in the book either. We do have things that we charge for and we have coaching programs and everything, yeah. But the book has everything you need to recover. And some people just like us to customize it for them and do it faster, stronger, better. So
very cool.
Well, defeatyourcravings.com. Yeah.
Defeatyourcravings.com. I'll put that in the show notes. Dr. Glenn Livingston, thank you so much for joining me. This has been super informative and very interesting. Hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Kevin. It was great. Thanks.
If you're looking to really maximize your life and become the man you were made to be, head over to maxedoutman.com and get your journey started today.